Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel. On the podcast today, we have Ruth Rogaski, Associate Professor of History and Asian Studies at Vanderbilt University, and she'll be talking about her new book, Knowing Manchuria, Environments, the Senses, and Natural Knowledge on an Asian Borderland, which was published in 2022 by University of Chicago Press. The question of how certain parts of the world acquire certain labels and reputations is often an intriguing one, from why European colonialists thought that sea monsters lurked at the edges of maps, to why East Asian visitors to Paris or London today feel let down by the messy realities of those places so different from their ideal types. The region known to some across time as Manchuria has had an especially wide range of ideas projected onto it, as diverse peoples have framed this vast space according to shifting political, spiritual, or scientific priorities, and through the epistemologies and technologies of their time. The distinct approaches to knowing Manchuria, taken by Manchu emperors, Chinese exiles, European missionaries, Korean poets, indigenous shamans, Russian botanists, Japanese colonists, and socialist planners, among, believe it or not, some others, in many ways have brought this place into existence. And these form the focus of Ruth Rogaski's extraordinary new book. Forming a deep exploration of the historical actors and rich ecologies of this region, this tome takes us on multiple journeys, many of them literal, into how different people at different moments sought to understand the Manchurian forests, mountains, plains, and earth that surrounded them, whether they came here voluntarily or not. Today, Manchuria is itself a contested term, and it can seem as though regional centres, particularly Beijing and Moscow, would rather not know the place at all. Those seeking to promote a multipolar order of global powers interacting on an abstract world stage find it inconvenient to consider fractious, layered borderlands. Consequently, Rogaski's multi-perspectival and multilingually sourced history of different ways of knowing and of entangled relations between people, place, and nature is all the more valuable an account of a region which we should all know better. So I'm happy to say, Ruth Rogaski, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Ed. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, as I was mentioning to you off air, also a great chance for me to talk about something which is absolutely the core of my interest and fascination. So I'm looking forward to the chat. But before we get into the contents of the book, perhaps I'll ask you about your kind of trajectory to this point, your academic background, and how you became interested in this fascinating region.
So my first book was about a different place with a different approach, hygienic modernity, focused on local history in Tianjin, the history of medicine, history of public health. And as I was doing that research, so this was quite some time ago, when I was interviewing some public health workers in the city, they started talking about the patriotic hygiene campaign and of the early 1950s and how that was in response to America's use of germ warfare in the Northeast. And of course, I had never heard of that. There really wasn't, that was not a widely known episode, or the allegations were not widely known. in the States. And when I started to look at some of the materials surrounding the allegations and the investigations, I found the massive report edited in part by Joseph Needham that brought together the various scientific investigations done in locales in Northeast China that attempted to prove the use of germ warfare. And one of the main thing that I noticed about it was that all the bibliographies, all the scientific literature used to prove what was indigenous nature and what was exogenous nature, all of the scholarship, or the vast majority of the scholarship, was written by those who were not indigenous. In other words, they're foreign scientists. So really, the book just started off many years ago as being curious about how scientists from around the world wound up in this region and how they struggled to make sense of the region, and then how that scientific knowledge was used toward the building of, initially, right, the PRC polity. So that was the genesis of it many, many moons ago.
Gotcha. Well, yeah, and you have that kind of background in at least North China, I suppose, in terms of previous research. But was the Northeast, broadly Manchuria, somewhere you'd spent any time previous to that, or was this a sort of totally new avenue?
Totally new. And for anyone, I mean, I so admire your border crossing work, but it's not easy going to deal with different places, different regimes. So actually the move to the Northeast was new for me and a bit fraught, but exhilarating at the same time.
Mm-hmm. I think that's in the spirit of the region. It was ever thus, or something. That's great. I guess that leads us fairly sort of naturally on to some broad kind of introductory ideas around the book as a whole. And you introduce the book with an introduction that actually focuses on an episode of flying or perhaps falling voles. we might return to the voles a little later on, but perhaps you can begin with a bit more of a description of, I guess, what Manchuria is, where it is, you know, for the purposes of grounding our discussion.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, in many ways, this whole book uses as a springboard the pioneering work of Mark Elliott, whose article, Limits of Tartary, really inspired me to think about this region as an imaginary construct, but one that was full of political, social, and cultural import. So, several of my interlocutors said, well, how can you write a book about a place that doesn't exist? And I said, well, the book in some ways is just engaging with that process of imagining this place. So the idea that, I'm trained as an historian of China, so we naturally slip into Dongbei, right? But what I felt was somewhat lacking in the scholarship, or the scholarship is out there, but it maybe not brought together, was the fact that, for other observers, this might not be Dongbei, but, Shibei, or in other words, the place, in the way the place was imagined, relied upon the perspective and locale of the imaginer. And I simply wanted to initially start bringing in more of these voices, more of these perspectives to try to feel out the very fuzzy entity that is Manchuria from these multiple perspectives.
Mm-hmm. And I mentioned a few of those in very general terms in the introduction, but perhaps you could say a few more things about who the people are that have sought to know it and why it is that so many different people, different constituencies have sought an understanding.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think my impulse was to start with the various polities going around the region. Although simultaneously, I thought I shouldn't go from skirting around the outside to talking from the inside out. I think it took a while for China scholars to realize the importance of this region for Koreans and observers on the Korean Peninsula going back centuries. So forays, up north beyond the peninsula itself, I think were very important in understanding what the spiritual, in particular, spiritual importance of this region. When I tried to move to northern perspectives, here I have something of a mishmash of Manchu surveyors who in the early Qing, right, with the help of indigenous guides, go all the way up to what I like to consider the same latitude as the Aleutian Islands. You know, I spend a lot of time on Google Maps, just zooming in, zooming out, in lieu of having a spaceship, and seeing the northern expanse of the Qing Empire as it was kind of sketched in. But I chose to look at a 19th century moment when European-based sciences came to the region. And in chapter 4, looking at botanists who, for me, fortunately, wrote in German, since that is a language that I'm conversant with, and their perspectives coming from, well, an empire situated to the north, but really coming from the western regions and coming into this locale. So European science really coming in from the north and the west. Really the book starts with you already mentioned the early Qing Han Chinese exiles. And there, I thought a great deal about what it would take to walk or to go in an ox cart from the Jiangnan environment to Ningguta. So everyone, most of these perspectives are moving in, and I emphasize the journey and I emphasize the shifting perspectives. But there are, for me, difficult moments to sketch out, but moments where I could see more local perspectives. And in order to do that, mostly I turn to things like shamans' chants or the botanical knowledge of Heja or Nanai people. So those were some of the multiple perspectives that I tried to weave in.
Mm. Yeah, that's great, and it's a sort of rich sense of these different, well, precisely ways of knowing that really forms the patchwork of the book, which is nevertheless one that's so kind of cumulative and layered, because it also sort of follows this broadly kind of chronological structure in a sort of broad sweep, whilst not just sort of rigidly moving from one time to the next. But since you mentioned the European kind of often Russian mediated various botanists and other, practitioners of whatever kind of post-enlightenment European science type methods, those are the people, I don't think it's too much of a stretch to suggest an Anglophone academic reader at a Western institution might have the most natural sympathy with. So I wonder, when it comes to understanding different epistemological constructions or ways of exactly approaching this space, how do you see is the best way to get at these different ways of knowing, given that, you know, there is the natural quote-unquote understanding of the relationship, for example, between person and nature, person and environment, that you as a writer might have? How do you sort of try to delve into these, whether they're, as you say, indigenous or just pre kind of Euro-globalization type ways of thinking about things?
No, that's a great question. And what I tried to do, and it's a method that evolved over the course of the years that I traveled to this region and walked the terrain. What I really tried to do was, I think, and chapter four about the botanists is maybe the clearest discussion of this method. I tried to gauge, not judge, but sketch out different degrees of entanglement. I think you used the word entanglement at one point, and this became important to me as I was writing the book. I really see the book primarily as a methodological intervention, as opposed to any particular stating any particular set of facts about Manchuria or about the history of China. So what my curiosity really revolved about, what was the embodied engagement between humans and the environment, among humans and other than human, to create what you know many scholars today would call a more than human world. And so I really turned to what I could best understand as physical engagement. And so, especially with that fourth chapter on botany, trying to understand the actual techniques, the physical techniques and the ways of seeing that resulted in European botanical knowledge, and the physical techniques and ways of sensing, not always just visual, but also tactile and what I call visceral knowledge, ingestion-based sensing, how these embodied forms of knowledge were conducted and how they might differ. So that's, and to do that, in some ways, I just relied on my own body, traveling through space, my own body looking out over a terrain. As faulty and full of caveats as that technique might be, I found it could be a good illuminating start.
Mm. Well, I mean, that personal sort of reflection on positionality is something that does form a really helpful component of the scene setting in the introduction of the book. What did you actually do? I guess is the direct way of putting the next question I have about sort of your methodological approach, both in terms of selection of sources. As you say, there was this starting point, perhaps with a moment in a much more recent sort of historical time and within a Chinese context. But how did you sort of go about foraging, perhaps might be the right word for your source base, and also in terms of embodied time spent in the region, how did that sort of pan out?
Yeah, so another fantastic question, coming from someone who has such deep experiences in the region itself. My foraging started in the place where I was taught how to forage, which is the archive. And it could be, and of course, my first book is heavily archival based. And so that was what I knew, that's what I loved, and for all of its frustrations. But of course, the time spent researching this book was also the time during which archives in the PRC became, there were more and more strictures to access. And this became actually, I think for the Northeast, became apparent even earlier than it may have for other places. So there was, in some ways, this is a book born of frustration. It's lemonade from the lemons that I started to encounter. The other bunch of lemons besides the archive, the main inspiration was my first climb up Baekdusan, Changbaishan, the Long White Mountain, or Whitehead Mountain. And So that was in 06. And climbing the mountain, so I had been doing a lot of reading and was already in the mode of thinking of this as a sacred place. And when I arrived there, two things struck me. One, I couldn't see it. I couldn't find it until I was actually on top of it, or about to be on top of it. Or I didn't realize I was already halfway up the mountain before I realized, oh, this is the mountain. So just sensing the terrain from the position of being in the terrain was such a revelation to me. The other thing was getting to the top, descending down to the caldera lake, and not being able to go around the lake, which from the region, the mountain and the lake itself was probably the most beautiful place I've ever been on this earth. And I had an intensely emotional reaction to the fact that borders inhibited my ability to engage with this environment. Now, you know, one thing I've thought about a lot since writing the book was, well, perhaps it's a good, you know, those borders are keeping my white butt from my white colonialist butt. You know, in other words, it's like, who am I, given my own positionality, to rage against borders? But what it did, what that experience did, was prompt me to start thinking of border transcending ways of perceiving these environments to the best of my ability. So most of my travels were on the PRC side of the border, but every place that I wrote about, I traveled to. It got more and more difficult as the years progressed. And my last stop was, I think, 2017, in what I kept calling the Sino-Soviet border to my colleagues. I realized, whoops, not Sino-Soviet, but the Sanjiang Pingyuan, the area where the Yusuri and Amur and Songhua rivers come together. So those were the things I tried to do. But it was because I was frustrated, primarily because I turned to the earth because I was frustrated by the paper archive.
Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't read only as a sort of last resort. I think it's it has a very strong and significant place within the overall picture. And incidentally, I'd add as a footnote that I think lots of people actually locally would also refer to that border area as Sino-Soviet, or at least the the country across the river of Sulian, a Soviet Union, that's still very much alive in the consciousness. So I don't think you have too much to worry. All you were doing was voicing emic perspectives there. So no problem. Anyway, well, that's great, Ruth. Thank you for that sort of overall grounding of how the project came together. So as I mentioned already, the chapters unfold in a sort of broadly chronological perspective, but that isn't really the main point, I think, because each one of them encapsulates at least one, if not several, different ways of knowing this place that have been practiced between, broadly, I suppose, the mid to late 17th century and the late 20th century. We begin kind of in that vein, I suppose veins being a key term also that arises here in relation to dragons, but with the Qing and especially the sort of early to mid Qing, the kind of expansion and efflorescence of this vast, ultimately multinational, multi-ethnic empire, which arose in many regards from this region. Could you say something then about how this region, which looked at from a contemporary China as Dongbei, right, as you've said, northeast China, looks like a kind of peripheral space? How did different constituencies within the Qing Empire, ruled by Manchus, but peopled largely by not Manchus, in many cases by Han Chinese, how did those different constituencies look at this region and attempt to understand it?
So that is really the crux of the book, right? That's what I try to do throughout each chapter. So I think I guess the way I might want to approach that question is to suggest an overarching trajectory of those particular viewpoints. The book itself really is an exercise in exploding monoliths. In many ways, simply want to state that there is no there, but that we have to try to grasp and hold within our minds these multiple perspectives. And so I do, I start in some ways simply because I was entranced by their poetry. I start by looking at the Han Chinese exiles who journey there. Part of the reason I did that was because I had a strong sense that for many observers whose writings we have, including people like Manchu emperors, there was always a journey involved to this place. And it existed in the mind prior to it existing in the eye. The overall trajectory in the expanse of the book is really to think about how a place that is thought of as a center of the dragon vein, the powerful earthbound, earthborn spiritual resonances that emerge from the sacred white mountain and the tombs of the progenitors of the imperial line, how this goes from being the sacred space to being a space where the earth itself is exploited for different forms of energy. I think that, you know, I talk a little bit about energy transitions, that the energies that are seen as emanating from the White Mountain and through traveling through dragon veins in Manchuria are very much in some ways mined, M-I-N-E-D, mined by the Qing Imperium. But there is, and you know, along with the actual, you know, things like furs and freshwater pearls and ginseng, there, you know, Manchuria has always been a place of extraction, but I tried to show an overall shift in perspectives on extraction that happens in the late 19th and early 20th century with the rise of global capitalism and the hitching of science and technology to the wagon of capitalist exploitation of natural terrain. So that's, you know, that's really the arc of the book. And all of the little pieces of different perspectives, while I'm trying to explode the region, simultaneously, I'm also trying to show a temporal arc and changes in epistemology and approaches to the environment.
Mm. So in this early to mid kind of Qing period with which you begin, and which broadly, I guess, is covered in the first couple of chapters, which deal respectively with these landscapes or narratives of exile in this landscape, and then secondly with the 1682 Kangxi expedition to this region, you do kind of... I guess describe ways of understanding this place that rely variously on poetic forms, on ways of comparing the landscape to known legible landscapes outside, kind of, or you know, elsewhere in China, in the case of some of these Chinese poets. So, did you see those as being kind of quite distinct? Kind of ways of understanding the region as a whole that maybe reinforced the separateness of Qing and or of Manchu rulers of the Qing and the Han constituents. I know this is, you know, you mentioned, I only asked this because you mentioned drawing on Mark Elliott's work, and of course a lot of Yu Qing history, if you like, and the exploration of this period, including in this region, has debated the kind of Qing universalism versus, as it relates to a sort of Manchu particularism. Did you see there being a kind of Manchu way of looking at this place versus a Han Chinese way of looking at this place, or is it not quite so simple as that?
I don't think it's as simple as that. I'm not sure if I was aiming for an explicit comparison. Some fantastic scholarship, David Bellow, Schlesinger's book on the world trim and fur, really talk about the imperial court's perspective on their northeastern territories as a place of, both of natural purity, but also as a place that provides the court and the Qing world with their luxury goods. So when I shifted from the Han Chinese exiles who are trying to make sense of a place where the sun doesn't set and where plants seem different, but they seem the same at the same time, I'm suggesting that there's a sense of shifting borders. Mental borders, as the Qing Empire makes this region part of the larger polity, and I think that even the Qing court, as represented by this the second Eastern the second Dongxun that Kangxi leads is also grappling with a place that's relatively foreign to most of them, and a sense of shifting boundaries, shifting beneath their feet as they move forward. And I think the one consistent thing that we see out of I use Gao Shiqi's account, Verbeest's account, and some poems ostensibly written by Kangxi along the way, and Shilu and things like that. The one consistent thing I see is Kangxi almost almost desperately using violence to stamp this place as, yes, this is a violence, of course, against other species. As a way of stamping an imperial imprint on this region,
right, through hunting and stuff, right?
The hunt, and also just the fact that I'm reading this stuff and I'm like, dude, it's March. Why? I mean, obviously we know why he wanted. I do think that Kangxi knew what he was doing by taking his entourage up there. It's like Vermont in what's called mud season, right? You don't go anywhere without your four-wheel drive. But it's also in some ways inflicting violence on the bodies of his own courtiers and retinue.
Mm-hmm. Some might suggest that four-wheel drive users have the same imperial attitude that someone self-designated as the son of heaven might possess. But I'm sure he didn't have to personally worry about too many of the hardships. I think that makes a lot of sense, as you said. This was, in many ways, a process and a way of understanding this place, or a process of grasping at an understanding of this place that defies easy categorization into this was how Manchu people saw it, or this is how Chinese people from the Neidi, from the central part of the empire, saw it, because this place is simultaneously a source and a kind of outflowing point of Manchu spiritual and sort of quasi-ethnic legitimacy, but also somewhere that is a destination where those same Manchu rulers send exiles and banish people right from the core of the empire. So it really doesn't fit so neatly into this is what this place was for these people. I think you're right there. But then, so moving into the kind of mid part of the book, We have an entire chapter dedicated to the mountain, which you mentioned earlier, Pektasan or Changbaishan, which exactly as you've mentioned is something that is quite hard to sort of identify as a mountain on approach. But once you're there, you're in no doubt at all that you're at the summit of something extremely large and powerful. But could you say then a bit more about why it was so significant? It's a very simplistic question maybe, but what made this mountain so significant to the various people that surrounded it?
Just automatically went to a modern explanation in my brain, and it's the volcano. but I do think there's something to it. And in the book, I tried really hard, because I was critiqued on this point, to avoid doing what had in the past was a fairly common environmental history approach, which was, first, you situate this place in its reality by using scientific literature and a scientist's perspective, that data to, and then you move into what your people's thought about the place, so in chapter three, what I try to do is citing the White Mountain. What I tried to do was present science as one way of thinking about the place, and it's a language that we moderns understand. So here I go. I'm going to do this anyway and explain that, you know, using ice cores pulled from Greenland and tephra mounds in Hokkaido in these sorts of ways, scientists have informed us that in such and such a year, there was a massive, massive eruption of this volcano. And it happened at a time of political turmoil in Northeast Asia. And even though there's no written records of it, in the way, Vesuvius blows and there's lots of folks around to write about it. But if Pektasan blows, we don't really have the written records prior to more or less an early modern period. But I think that it's the explosive nature. I mean, when you climb it, I never really thought about it as a volcano. I probably should have, since it was rumbling at the time. I just didn't know it. But for people in that region, knowing that the explosive nature of it, when the millennial eruption sent a plume up into the sky that was, at least according to the way, as much as scientists can figure it out, that was more dramatic than the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So I would venture a guess that sort of activity from a formation in your neighborhood would cause people to think of it in a certain way.
No, that's understandable. And I guess temporally, I think you suggest that it lies at a kind of point at which it would have been a kind of fairly fertile moment for nourishing narratives of ethnic and national origin on the part of both Manchus right to the north of the mountain and of Koreans too to the south, who see Tangun, this legendary ancestor, to have sort of arisen from this mountain, and indeed contemporary North Koreans who see another sort of spiritual ancestor in the form of Kim Jong-il to have emerged from this mountain. But in any case, that's a sort of great, core pivot in many ways of the book as a whole there in chapter three, just as the mountain itself is a sort of pivotal point of the region, even though it lies at the very edge, one very southern eastern edge of the region as a whole. You've actually provided a link quite well there to thinking in the latter part of the book about the sort of eruption of these modern, used analytically ways of looking at this region that come in the very end part of the Qing, with the also arrival of the end part of the Russian Empire into this area, and then subsequently over the 20th century. So once you get to the point where you're describing, as we've mentioned already, botanists as well as mining prospectors and fossil hunters and also plague scientists later, all kinds of other peoples, how do efforts to understand this place change, and does it all change at once, or is there a sort of layered transition from these more complex ways of knowing this landscape? Does the spiritual end up interacting with the scientific, to put it in very blunt terms?
Well, here I think it's important for us to realize that there are spiritual underpinnings. We simply typically don't call them spiritual underpinnings. But there are, I think in the book, I call them fantasies, which there are urges, mythologies, ideas that drive science as well. And here, the underpinning, the underpinning spirituality, as it were, is for what happens in the 20th century is this idea, this myth of the potential for always expanding extraction of resources, always expanding progress, always expanding wealth. That drives, that is as at the heart of the forms of exploitation, environmental exploitation, and the sciences that undergird that those exploitations of resources. So I think that what you'd find primarily is that the texts reflect a shift in spirituality. as opposed to spiritual, and here I'm messing with the words spirit and spiritual, right? But if you want to call it intellectual underpinnings that people feel in their hearts and it drives them, perhaps we're talking about the same sort of thing, albeit with different outcomes.
I think centering the people who are working in harmony or in sympathy with these sorts of broad ways of thinking is probably the best approach, right? Because then we stop short of saying that modern science is just another religion, or not that that is a totally indefensible position, but it's a very complicated to defend sort of a position, or at least would require the book to be about lots of things that aren't anything to do with Manchuria. So I think it is your person-centered, your character-centered sort of approach here that really brings out those sorts of shifting commitments. Perhaps if we can just say a few things about some of these specific people, maybe even jumping forward to around the time that you said was your sort of entry point to the project as a whole. How does the scientific approach during the 20th century, especially among Chinese scientists, but perhaps also with the help in some cases of Soviet ones or other figures in this region, to things like plague, and then ultimately those flying voles as well that we mentioned. What does that tell us about sort of the place of Manchuria within a kind of emerging new Chinese order in the 20th century?
Well, I talk about the flying voles, so the rodents that were allegedly dropped from planes, from airplanes, and land in across a series of villages in Heilongjiang.
And not this 1952, I think, right?
I'm going there. It's a pretty short chapter that follows a much longer chapter about plague research as done by Chinese and Japanese scientists in the earlier 20th century. And the title of the chapter is Scientific Redemption. So what I saw, being unable to solve the problem, the question of whether or not it actually happened, think of that problem as not particularly interesting for a historian of science. What I try to probe is the uses of these scientific investigations for the building of new China, this new polity that is effecting control over a place that has been contested for really centuries at this point. So what I saw was a very clear attempt at using science to indicate what was the nature that belonged within the borders of China, of New China. And what was quite interesting, though, was that the scientists who were generating this, the Chinese scientists who were generating this data, most, if not all of them, had backgrounds. Their education was their instruction in science was acquired abroad. And in the case of the epidemiologists and bacteriologists that worked on the germ warfare investigations in Dongbei, these Chinese scientists had studied actually in Japan during or in either Manchukuo establishments, or many had gone to Japan during the after 1931. So I couldn't delve into that as deeply as I wanted to. I simply noted these educational backgrounds and recognized that there was redemption. There were redemptive projects going on all around through using science to redeem the area from its history of conquest, domination, and attempted colonization, to redeem it from its reputation as a diseased, singularly diseased place, and potentially on the part of the scientists themselves, attempts to redeem their pasts of cooperating, I almost said collaborating, cooperating with international science, which was intertwined with imperialism in the mid 20th century.
Mm, yeah, I think that sort of using science, a new Chinese based PRC science, to combat Japanese imperial science, as you mentioned, some of the kind of horrible experiments and things done in Harbin during the Japanese colonial period, and indeed also to combat, I guess, earlier iterations of these imperial colonial kind of models, which have entered the region from Russia and then more broadly in China from other colonial powers. It's a very interesting sort of case study and a site for exploring these different ways of knowing and the power that comes with understanding a place, a very interesting comparison with these earlier overlapping ways of knowing the region that we've discussed already, between those that sort of have their roots in kind of Manchu particularistic explanations of what's going on, or Korean, maybe a bit less explored in our conversation. But I think the sort of way that these paradigms are sort of also advanced to sort of claim or to defend or to incorporate, in many cases, geography and nature, increasingly incorporate, I guess, later as nation statehood, is sort of a big motive for, wanting to discuss or describe this region. It's a absolutely kind of fascinating and many layers tapestry that we haven't had time to get into at every level, unfortunately. But perhaps to sort of close us out, or to bring us back to what you said yourself was the final stop on your own personal fieldwork expeditions to this area, the Sanjiang Plain. We end with the sent down youth of the Cultural Revolution era and this kind of final mass form of understanding this area. That as the kind of apogee or the final point of knowing that is visited in the book, where does that leave us in terms of understanding the many layers that go all the way back to that late Qing period. Have these things all, do you think, contributed equally when it comes to knowing Manchuria as we or as people might today? And do you think this is something very specific to this region, or could a similar kind of investigation of ways of knowing a place be conducted anywhere else?
Those are fantastic questions, and I'll give it a try here. You're correct that I end the book with the sent down youth, and of course the cultural outpouring of this group makes it easier to there's just so many rich sources there to work with, that it becomes a bit easier to write a vivid, embodied history using these sources. But, you know, there could have been a very different way of writing this book, and that would have been to have tried to understand perspectives on the region from the viewpoint of those who labored there. So I end the book with really suggesting that that the knowledge built through labor is perhaps at a sort of apogee of embodied knowledge, and forms the broadest base of what it means to know a place. People whose bodies, in some ways, I mean, of course, for the sent down youth, are sacrificed to maintain human life in a place. So there could have been a different way. You know, I could have tried to have traced a labor history back to, say, the quasi serfs who worked on Qing manorial farms back going into the 1600s. You know, there's scholarship on this, but one could try to turn it on its head and make it an embodied, entangled history, perhaps by looking at farming implements, for example. I think is a looking at material culture. The material culture of labor could be an interesting way of going about it. But that's not what I did. But if I were to take the concluding spirit of that last chapter and work it through the entire book, that's what I would do, and to suggest that indeed it's through labor that places are ultimately known.
I mean, that kind of, just as an aside, draws me to think a little about the way that some of these early PRC or kind of high Mao era exiles or sent down people ejected from the center are often seen as the, if there are such a thing, the kind of good settlers in some of the peripheral regions of China, right? Whether it's here is a different case, particularly given the historical population of the area, but Xinjiang, for example, is somewhere where people who came there at this point are seen as somehow a bit more attached, you know, the whatever Lao Xinjiang Ren, the old Xinjiang people. I mean, the kind of sent down youth of the mid 20th century in Dongbei maybe have a similar labor-born attachment and some claim to an embodied attachment to that land. I don't know if that's over romanticizing histories of violent settlement and dispossession. If it is, I'm very sorry about that. But it just kind of occurs to me that it does seem that in general you sort of earn a little bit of cred in your way of understanding and way of being attached to a place if you've kind of labored there, as you suggest.
Yeah. So that, you know, it's hard for me, and given that it was a mass phenomenon, then we simply have to acknowledge acknowledge that this is particularly generative way of knowing Manchuria at this point in our history. I think if there's a value established there, it's the value of labor in and of itself. So skirting perhaps some of the difficult political questions that you've just
That's entirely fine. No, I should probably skirt them more myself. But no, I think that's great, Ruth. Well, thank you very much. That's been a really great exposition of the book as a whole. As I mentioned already, there's an absolutely enormous amount of extremely rich and un-get-to-able material in there within a one-hour conversation. So thank you very much for appearing. Before we let you go, though, it would be great if you could say something about what you've been working on since Manchuria. I gather that it's not really quite, it's not necessarily quite as far from your own base as this book was.
Yeah, well, although in some ways there's inspiration from my conclusions that it behooves us to look at the local to understand a broader phenomenon. I am working on Chinese medicine in Nashville, Tennessee, where Vanderbilt University is, and the place where I've lived for the past 15 years. So it's a combination of contemporary history and more sort of anthropological, observations of what Chinese medicine means to practitioners and to patients, to sufferers in the community that I'm part of. So that's my current project, a little bit easier to research in these pandemic years. But really, I think there's a continuity with this book because of my obsession, shall we say, with exploring the local.
Right, and also perhaps with different ways of knowing things. In this case, perhaps the body and the sort of, I don't know, zoological dimension of human existence.
Yes.
Anyway, fantastic. Thank you very much, Ruth. It's been really great talking to you today.
Oh, I've had a wonderful time. Thank you so much, Ed.
And listeners, thank you too, as ever, for listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. It's a podcast channel on the New Books Network, and it will be back with you again very soon. Goodbye.